Hello everyone, this is Maz. If you're hearing this message, it means you're not part of the Voices of War subscriber community and will only hear the first half of the episode. If that's enough, then I'm thrilled. However, if you're looking to dive deeper into the complexities of war, please consider subscribing to our private feed by using the link at the top of the show notes. By doing so, you'll gain access to all of our episodes, the ability to ask follow-up questions, and we'll become part of an exclusive community that makes this show possible. I hope you'll make the decision to join us today.
But what bothers me actually is we haven't won a war since World War II. If you're tying yourself to a broader alliance framework, then in some ways your moral legitimacy is now hostage to the moral legitimacy of your major ally. And it was a really major problem for us when the US began to lose moral legitimacy after the invasion of Iraq. China, between now and the end of this decade, is going to be as strong as it's ever going to be relative to the United States. The first minute of a war between China and the United States, most of the satellite systems that we're so reliant on go out. A lot of the offshore fiber optic cables that run our economy go. Our ability to import or export would go away. It wouldn't take much to convince somebody in, say, the Chinese Ministry of State Security that interfering in the 2024 election, and I'm not talking with Twitter and memes, I'm talking with ammunition, right, might potentially solve a really important strategic problem for China, right? The Russians are not doing anywhere near as badly as they might be portrayed in Western media, but they're also not doing anywhere near as well as they might be portrayed in like Sputnik or RT, right? The chance of a quick victory, either Russia quickly defeating Ukraine or Ukraine quickly defeating Russia, is just not on the cards.
My guest today is Dr. David Kilcullen, who, as most in the audience will know, is a renowned military strategist, scholar, and former soldier and diplomat who has served both the Australian and United States governments for three decades now. He's an expert in the fields of guerrilla warfare, terrorism, urbanization, and the future of conflict. Among his many achievements, David played an instrumental role in the development of the surge strategy in Iraq in 2007, served as the senior counterinsurgency advisor to US General David Petraeus, and served as a special advisor for counterinsurgency to US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. David has authored several influential books, including The Accidental Guerrilla, Counterinsurgency, Out of the Mountains, The Dragons and Snakes, How the Rest Learned to Fight the West, and The Ledger, Accounting for Failure in Afghanistan. He has been named one of foreign policy's top 100 global thinkers and has won numerous awards for his writing. His work is widely used by policymakers, the military, intelligence services, and development agencies around the world. Dave, thank you very much for joining me on The Voices of War.
Maz, it's an honor to be here, mate. I'm glad to join you.
Fantastic. So before we dive into some juicy topics on war, it might be good to get to know a little more about you and your background. What made you join the army in the first place? And later, how did you end up transitioning to academia?
Yeah, great question. So I joined the army right out of high school in 1985. I was in the last class at Duntroon before the tri-service, you know, ADFA, Australian Defence Force Academy, was stood up. And in the middle of the 1980s, weirdly enough, Australia had been at peace for, you know, quite some time, at least 12 years since the end of the Vietnam War. A lot of my instructors at Duntroon had served in Vietnam and or Malaya and or Borneo. I had some of the, you know, the most talented counter-revolutionary warfare, you know, jungle fighters that have ever lived, you know, as my as my instructors at Duntroon.
That's impressive.
And I think that kind of shaped my my life path, just the inspiration of those guys and the kinds of conflict that, you know, in my youth, the Australian Army was recognized as a global leader in and sort of took for granted. Interestingly, that my first deployment operationally was 1997. from there onwards, it was just, you know, one thing after another, right?
Back to back, yeah.
Back to back. So, you know, looking back on it, it turns out that that period between about 1973 and 1986 was the anomaly, you know? Mm, I mean, my regiment, the Royal Australian Regiment, was continuously at war from when it was founded in 1948 through to 1973, you know? Mm, and then it has been continuously at war since 9/11. So, you know, I think... I was in some ways lucky to come into the army during a period where we still had time to reflect and think about things, and not just be, you know, rolling with the punches in a conflict environment.
Mm-hmm. Had you always wanted to be a soldier? Had that been a childhood dream?
I wouldn't say a childhood dream, but pretty much for as long as I can remember, I've been, you know, fascinated with conflict and war and thinking about, you know, serving Australia from a nationalistic standpoint. And that all sort of came together as I was ending my time at high school and decided that that was my, you know, my pathway.
That's your path.
I guess sort of more vocational than anything else, right? I mean, it hasn't just been my career and my job. It's been a vocation for me. You know, getting into academia, I would even say, I'm sort of in academia. I mean, I'm a professor, obviously, at ADFA, but I teach special operations. I teach, you know, contemporary strategy. I teach for an American university at Arizona State. I teach future military innovation. So I'm still in the game and still working really closely, of course, with, you know, with people that you and I know that are dealing with these challenges on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I was going to say that. And that's, strikes me as an anomaly, which is perhaps this kind of soldier philosopher or soldier academic angle, is that you're still well and truly in touch with the everyday. And as you mentioned, some of the people we know, I mean, they're dealing with problems that are very much real now, today, and how to change tomorrow, which is perhaps different to many other professors, I would say, certainly the ones that I've come across in my my time, that tend to focus on the historical concept. Yeah.
One of the weird things that happened during the fall of Kabul in 2021 was that I was working the evacuation really hard with a bunch of Afghan colleagues and a network of people on the ground, including some of my master's students from from the Defence Academy who are also deployed to deal with that. And it was quite an interesting dynamic to be working with your students on a current operational task. I mean, what I like to say is, you know, as you go through your career, you don't move up the chain from tactical to strategic. Because reality is tactical, right? You have to stay grounded in tactical reality. Otherwise, the advice you're giving and your understanding of the environment are just unrealistic.
Yeah.
So it's really, really important to stay grounded. And I do that by spending as much time as I can with actual combat troops in the field. But also, you know, my students in particular, keep me pretty grounded in what's going on the ground.
And live. And it's interesting you mentioned that particular instance about Afghanistan, the withdrawal, because that was an interesting part. And I was involved in, you know, on the edges as well of some of those private, informal, I guess, withdrawals of people or getting people out of the country in whichever way possible. And it seemed at times that the informal network was vastly more connected and empowered and free to go and do things than the formal chains. I wonder if you had seen that and what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I think we were very fast on the ground with the informal networks of people that had worked a lot in Afghanistan. And, you know, those of us that still had networks on the ground were able to mobilize those networks really quickly to help each other. It was almost an insurgent-style structure where people came in to do a job and partnered up with each other and stayed partnered based on capability. But I would just caveat that by saying none of that would have worked if we didn't have really capable government people, you know, inside the wire on Kabul Airport. And I was in direct touch with the Australian force through a couple of different channels. And you know, the Australians are actually very active and very adaptive in Kabul, and I would contrast them favorably, frankly, with the Americans and others, actually. Our guys were very, let's say, proactive in getting the job done. And I think that's that. I found that quite reassuring, right? Because even though it was an absolutely horrific set of circumstances, I wasn't embarrassed for our guys. I thought that, you know, ADF did particularly well in an extremely difficult set of circumstances. That was a great example of how you need to be able to adapt at the speed of the war. And if you have like a loose fabric network of cells and nodes that work together, you're likely to be much more adaptive than if you're the sort of chunky, you know, big order battle type structures. Yeah. And that's true of combat, by the way, as well as things like the evacuation.
Specifically speaking about Afghanistan, and I didn't want to get to it right away, but we may as well since we're here. It's been a good year and a half now since, I guess, the fall of Kabul and the incredibly rapid fall of the government and the takeover by the Taliban. How do you assess the current situation in Afghanistan and should we still worry about that? No, actually, let me rephrase that. I know we should worry, but how much should we worry about Afghanistan?
So the most important thing to understand about the situation in Afghanistan, I think, is that the Taliban are a lot weaker than they appear, right? There's a lot of factions. There's a lot of regional groupings within the Taliban. Many of them are very unhappy at the way that a particular clique sponsored by the Pakistanis around the so-called Haqqani network have really taken control of a lot of the administrative, you know, elements of running the emirate now in Afghanistan. So there's already been a number of pretty major uprisings and rebellions from within the Taliban against the group that's currently controlling Kabul. So on the one hand, they're quite weak in terms of their unity and their ability to actually govern. The second weakness is they just don't have a lot of people, frankly. I mean, they only have maybe 110,000 to 150,000 troops that can do everything from policing to securing 34 major cities to securing the countryside to protecting the borders. You know, they just don't really have the resources to...
That's less than we had.
At some peak, for sure. Significantly less than the Afghans had. So I think their control is pretty brittle. And I think what we're going to see is that as people start pushing back against them, which is already happening, they're going to be increasingly brutal as a way of shutting people down. So I think the notion that the Taliban are moderate and are going to moderate further is a bit of a fantasy. We already know they're working pretty closely with Al-Qaeda. So the, you know, Osama bin Laden's successor as head of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, was killed last year in Kabul while basically sunning himself on the rooftop deck of the chief of staff to the Taliban foreign minister, who was living in, you know, a Taliban government house in downtown Kabul, right? So the notion that they're somehow going to turn against Al-Qaeda, I think, is also weak. The final point I'd make is, you know, the Afghan people today are not the Afghan people of 2001. And the illustrative, I think, example of that is a few weeks ago, the Taliban finally said, okay, we told you when we first took over Kabul that women would be able to go back to school. We were just waiting for the situation to stabilize. But now we're actually saying there's no women's education. Women are not going back to school and they just need to stay at home and be behind the veil. And when that happened, hundreds of thousands of male students and professors went on strike in the major educational institutions in Afghanistan. So, you know, the men of Afghanistan are standing up for the women, and the, you know, the whole new generation of people who came up under democracy. I mean, it was a flawed democracy, but it was a genuine democracy. Those people aren't willingly going to go back to the 7th century, you know. So I think the story is absolutely not over yet, and I think, you know, the risk of terrorism should worry us a bit. I think that the risk of an attack outside of Afghanistan is real. It's not at the top of my list, though. I think the top of my list is that there could be another, you know, massive civil war inside Afghanistan, and that could lead to just mass population movement and humanitarian disaster on a scale that we really haven't seen. Mm. And it really worries me that the US government in particular seems to have totally checked out and be essentially uninterested in what's going on in Afghanistan. And it actually reminds me of how they were with Iraq after they withdrew in 2010 and until 2014 when ISIS came roaring out of the desert and totally turned the country upside down. The Iraqis couldn't get them on the phone to ask for assistance. They basically pretended like Iraq didn't exist anymore once they withdrew. Mm. So I worry that they're going through exactly the same dynamic now.
Why does the US do that? I mean, that's a given the investment in blood and treasure and supposedly strategic interests, which is what we're led to believe, or at least that's the narrative. How is it in the US interest to turn away from this?
It's clearly not, right? But I think a lot of US strategic decisions are made not in the interest of the United States, but in the interest of elites that control political decision-making in the United States.
That's interesting. So the reason saying that. Okay.
You know, the reason that there's been no accountability, that there's no engagement with the reality of the situation in Afghanistan, for example, is that would be embarrassing for the Biden administration. And everything now is about domestic US politics and winning the news cycle and partisan rivalry between Republicans and Democrats. Mm. And unfortunately, that's thoroughly replaced the old bipartisan consensus around, you know, the idea that politics stops at the water's edge and you then have to support national interest. That's just not a thing anymore in the States, even to the point where people are in differing reality, right? I mean, from a Republican standpoint, China is the major threat and Russia and Ukraine is a distraction. Mm. From the Democratic standpoint, there's Russians under every bed. The Russians have been interfering with our democracy and Russia's the threat and China is, you know, I think President Biden said they're not bad folks was his way of putting it. Mm. So I just think everything's now seen through a partisan lens and the degree of corruption and the degree of self-serving behavior by American elites of all kinds, right? The media, politicians, people in business and so on is really, for an Australian audience, is sort of literally hard to believe. And we often get negative on our own politicians, but actually there are streets ahead of where a lot of other places are. And I guess, you know, the other point that I'll make is that not a single person has been held accountable for the defeat in Afghanistan, right? So, you know, there was a lot of laughter in the US in March last year when the Russians fired 150 senior officials for the failure of their initial invasion of Ukraine. And I was like, yeah, well, that's 150 more people than we fired for losing a 20-year war in Afghanistan, which is a major military defeat. Like, let's not pretend otherwise, right? And not one person, not Secretary Austin or Chief of Staff Milley or General McKenzie, the commander of CENTCOM, or Secretary Blinken or Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, none of those people offered to resign. Mm. None of them was asked to resign. Nobody was fired. Actually, one guy was fired. There was a Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel who complained was being held accountable. He was thrown in jail. Nobody else was held accountable at all. So I just think if you can only do that so many times before people start to stop taking you seriously.
Mm. Is that what you think is happening in the US?
I think China and Russia do not take the US seriously anymore as a deterrent threat. And I think the collapse in Afghanistan and the fact that it was pretty quickly swept under the rug was one of the key factors that I think the Russians took into account when they decided that they would probably get away with the invasion of Ukraine, you know, 6 months after the fall of Kabul. Mm. And the very same things that the US government was saying about undying permanent support for the Ukrainians were exactly the same stuff we were saying about the Afghans until about a week before the collapse of Kabul, right? So it was like we cried wolf and no one believed us.
And what we're saying to Taiwan as well, or what you were saying to
Taiwan. And what the Americans are saying to Australia, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Bang on. Right. You're speaking some really hard truths here, and I'm really, really pleased to hear it because it's not often that people in public speak, it's certainly not if your profile speak in this tone. How did the US get to this point? And perhaps more importantly, what does this say about the wars that we have fought? right? If we're willing to shift focus and shift priorities and change the narratives from an elite perspective, and I totally understand what you mean by the elites, like whether it's the media, politics, military-industrial complex, call it whatever you want, special interest groups, if they're capable of shifting policy of the most powerful nation of the world, you know, as some call it an informal empire that it's still is, if they're able to shift to go to wars, whether it be Iraq, and I want to talk about Iraq 2003 in particular in a moment, but Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, any of the wars that we have been to, what does that say about those wars? You know, what does it say about us, about future wars? Are we able to go into wars because of the interests of the elites as opposed to the actual interest of the nation?
Yeah, well, some would argue that that's always been the case. A guy called Smedley Butler, who was a very highly decorated general, wrote a book in the 1930s called War as a Racket, basically reflecting on his experience in small wars in Latin America in the 1920s and 1930s.
Well, as an ethnic Bosnian, I chuckle at that and I see a lot of truth in it.
Yeah, I mean, you can argue. And, you know, there's the whole notion of conflict entrepreneurs, which we're very familiar with in a developing world context, but there are also conflict entrepreneurs in developed countries. You know, so I think I would say for me as a professional soldier, the thing that bothers me is not so much what I think is an enduring feature of war, right? That it's elites that bring us to war and it's the ordinary people that fight them. But what bothers me actually is we haven't won a war since World War II, right? I mean, the last war that the US military convincingly won was in 1945. You know, Korea was basically a stalemate that was reified by an armistice. Vietnam was a defeat. There were a number of minor victories in different places during the 60s and 70s, you know, Grenada, Panama in the 80s, but, you know, a lot of other defeats. And then the Gulf War was transformative in its use of technology, but it didn't actually result in a resolution of the political issues over which the war was fought. So it doesn't actually meet the definition of strategic victory. It was a battlefield success.
Right.
And then, you know, Iraq was a defeat. Afghanistan was a defeat. Syria, ongoing, but likely to be a defeat. And all the war games we do looking at the possibility of a future conflict over Taiwan, the US tends to lose. So I think we need to ask ourselves whether this highly vaunted military that we keep getting told is the best in the history of the world. Well, if it can't actually win wars, you know, what is it for? And I think for Australians, that's an important point because, you know, it's a bipartisan article of faith across both major parties that the fundamental basis for our security is the US alliance. And I'm in no way opposed to the US alliance. I think it's super important. But I think that we need to be really clear-eyed about what the alliance can do and what it can't do. And it can't save us, right? It can't protect us if we can't protect ourselves. And I think the notion that the Americans will somehow come and rescue us or somehow deter a major conflict is not an accurate way to think about the situation. We need to be much more self-reliant and much more focused on our own national interests. And if we do that, I think that'll make us a better ally, actually. That's not an anti-alliance statement. It's a statement that we need to be capable and self-reliant and focused on our own national interest. And when that aligns with our allies, we'll be a strong partner, you know.
Yeah, that's, again, a hugely interesting point for Australia. And many are even arguing, has Australia made its bed too soon, perhaps with the US, given our strategic reliance, importance, and connection to China as our number one trading partner. Of course, we've already paid some price for, you know, maybe not necessarily alliance, but for the outspoken nature of Australian politicians, certainly during COVID. But I think that price stands to be much higher as we move forward, particularly with AUKUS, etc. What do you think? I mean, is it inevitable for Australia to side 100% with the US? And is there scope and opportunity for Australia to play some sort of a mediating role, to play a balanced role, to play a regional role, to be a regional leader, et cetera, et cetera? Or is this merely, as many are saying, you know, if the US says we go, which we have so far.
Yeah. So I think, and this is sort of a very big macro point, but you know, I think that the single organizing principle of all Australian statecraft, both diplomacy, economic, informational, and military, for the next generation needs to be preventing a war between the United States and China.
Mm.
That has to be our top goal. Mm. And the military component of that is going to be around deterrence and self-reliance and coalition capability and all that. But it needs to be under the umbrella of recognizing that our national goal needs to be preventing what would be an absolutely catastrophic war, right? Mm. I mean, it may very well go nuclear, but even if it doesn't, it would utterly destroy the planet as we know it, and it would completely tank Australia from a national interest standpoint.
Mm.
I mean, China is our biggest trading partner. China is also the US's biggest trading partner. It would completely destroy the economic fabric of the Asia Pacific. More importantly, you know, a war in between China and the United States wouldn't be contained just to the Taiwan Strait or the South China Sea.
Or to just those two nations.
Yeah, correct. It would rapidly spread. And for those, you know, I don't want to freak people out, but, you know, the we are so reliant on the import of things like petrol from overseas that, you know, if the Straits of Hormuz was to be cut off by a naval blockade as part of that kind of conflict, the country runs out of oil in about 3 weeks. We don't have the national resilience or the national stockpiles or the redundant systems that we would need to survive that kind of a conflict. I mean, the first minute of a war between China and the United States, most of the satellite systems that we're so reliant on go out. A lot of the offshore fiber optic cables that run our economy go. Our ability to import or export, you know, would go away. And again, like Australia has a different circumstance than the US does. The US runs a really major trade deficit with China. Australia runs an extremely major trade surplus with China. We export about $170 billion worth of goods to China every year. Fully 100 billion of that, billion with a B, is iron ore coming out of Western Australia. And interestingly, during that period of economic bullying by China against Australia, that was the one thing they never touched, right? That and metallurgical coal, right? Now, back
to it was a display. It was a it was posturing more than actually having an impact, right?
Right. Now, backing up to your point, I do not think that we should be kowtowing to China. I don't think we should be compromising on our values. I want to draw a distinction between China, the great global civilization of which a lot of Australians, you know, draw their heritage. There's been a, you know, really vibrant Chinese community in Australia for 150 years, you know, between that and the Chinese Communist Party. And the Chinese Communist Party here is the problem. And they don't share our values. They lie. They unleashed the pandemic on the world and then pretended that nothing had happened. I fully supported the way that our politicians stood up and showed some backbone during that and the way that we stood up under the bullying that we got as a result from China. But one of the things I found really interesting and quite gratifying during the early stage of the conflict, sorry, of the pandemic, is that Australia didn't sit back and wait for the US to take the lead. Australia stepped up and took the lead, and a lot of other middle powers in the Asia Pacific came to us and worked with us, right? It was almost like leadership from the middle. So rather than kind of lying back and waiting for, you know, the British Empire or the American Empire or whatever it is to kind of save us, I think it's really important that we act in a dynamic and take a leadership role within the region with our peer nations of like-minded countries. You know, obviously there's a military element to that, but I don't think it's in anyone's interest to go to war with China. That doesn't mean we won't, right? Yeah. We may very well end up doing that, right? We need to be ready for that.
And I guess that's an important point. I mean, it's obviously in someone's interest, right? And if we're talking about the elites again, I mean, in whose interest could it be to have such a war that would devastate the planet? And again, I often fear that many political leaders have never been on the receiving end of any types of munitions to have a true understanding of the absence of time that occurs or thought or the fear that one might experience under those circumstances, or if someone's loved one has been killed. I wonder if that's part of the reason that, you know, we're pursuing some interest for lack of an understanding of what we're actually, you know, choosing.
I do think we have a political class in most Western countries that's pretty disconnected from military service and doesn't really understand, you know, what's entailed. But I think it's actually a bit different. I think what's going on here is that neither the US nor the Chinese really want to fight each other, but they would rather fight them back down over critical issues. Mm. So taking the Chinese standpoint, you know, Xi Jinping is 69 years old. Mm. Mm. It's his life's legacy to recover Taiwan. He's now fully in control of the factional system within the Chinese Communist Party after the last party congress.
And he made that very obvious publicly by leading out the only competitor. Yeah,
correct. And he's... he's made it clear to the PLA that they need to be ready to move against Taiwan by 2027.
Mm.
Now, why is that? It's because China, between now and the end of this decade, is going to be as strong as it's ever going to be relative to the United States. After that, for reasons of demography and an aging population and economic structural issues, China's going to start to decline relative to the US.
Mm.
So they're going to be as close as they're ever going to be to be able to, you know, close that gap and recover Taiwan. And it's also the personal legacy of a guy who's about to become, you know, in his 70s and wants to get it done. So I think there's an urgency to the Chinese where they would rather not fight for Taiwan. And certainly they don't want to inherit a smoking hulk, which they then need to spend a generation rebuilding. But if it's a choice of fight for it now or lose it forever, they may choose to fight. Likewise, the US knows that it's a declining power, knows that Russia and China are now very much aligned with each other and also with Iran, knows that its credibility is declining partly through its own actions of the last 20 years and is desperate to reassert dominance and will not tolerate China reaching the sort of peer status that the Chinese believe is their right. So, again, I don't think the Americans want to fight over Taiwan, but would they fight over Taiwan rather than permanently lose their primacy in the global system? I think they probably would, you know.
Sorry, finish your sentence.
Well, I just worry that we're sort of sleepwalking into conflict, right, that people don't realize quite how high the stakes are and how it won't necessarily be rational, right, when we get into it. And I also think, you know, these things take on a life of their own. And I don't want to give you a PTSD flashback, mate, but you think about, you know, think about Milosevic, right? Coming out in Kosovopolia at the end of the 80s and starting up this, you know, Serbian nationalist movement within Yugoslavia, largely for his own interests inside the elite of Yugoslavia as it was then constituted. I don't think he had a particular desire to break up the country. He didn't want to see... you know, a long civil war. You know, it was no one's intention for that. But then when Slovenia pushed back and managed to successfully separate, it started this cascade. And once enough people get killed, it takes on a life of its own, you know, and it's really, really hard to put that genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point and a really important point once enough people are killed. And again, I don't think that's something people really talk about because then it becomes a much bigger piece. The more suffering, the more people have suffered, the more anger builds, the more resentment builds, and it, as you said, it finds a life on its own. But I did find interesting that it's about the primacy. Maybe I'll ask you this as a question: what are US and China competing over? Let's just double click on that, and I just want to build on that a little bit.
Yeah. So let's go grand strategy. Yeah, yeah. You know. Yeah. Of the 21st century, right? The US is looking to preserve its primacy over the global system, sometimes described as the rules-based international order. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes described as the 1945 consensus or the Washington consensus. Mm-hmm. So the set of institutions that were put in place after the last war that we actually won.
IMF, World Bank, and these institutions
IMF, UN, World Bank, the Bretton Woods institutions, you know, mm-hmm. all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then informal things like the petrodollar, right? The mm-hmm. fact that, you know, international transactions are conducted in the US dollar as the reserve currency and all that. The US wants to preserve that primacy. Now, to argue the American point of view for a second, mm-hmm. their argument would be, and there's a lot of truth in this, that American dominance of the global system has coincided with one of the greatest outpourings of human freedom and prosperity and globalization and global growth in recorded history, right? Mm-hmm. So it's been good for not only America, but also America's allies, but even people that are opposed to America have benefited from, you know, the peace and stability of American primacy. Mm. So that sometimes shades over into an argument that I think is harder to sustain, which is the argument that, look, US dominance is good for everybody. Therefore, everybody has an interest in the US being the dominant player. So if anybody goes against the US, they're not just going against the US, they're going against everybody, which makes them a so-called rogue nation.
Mm.
And therefore, the US is justified in doing whatever it needs to do, whether that fits normal global rules or not, in order to preserve the order from which everybody benefits, right? So this sort of American exceptionalism and unilateralism and things that, you know, have often given America a bad name since the beginning of the century, in many cases come out of this belief that American dominance is good for everybody, and therefore America should be free to do what it needs to do in order to preserve that primacy. I think the Americans see that primacy being challenged. They see it being challenged internally, but also with, you know, with the rise of a populist style of politics in the US and the disenchantment of the US people with 20 years of inconclusive war and financial crises and inflation and all that. So I think they see it being challenged, and there's an external adversary that has come to embody that challenge, and it's China and Russia, depending on which side of American politics you're on. So I think that's the drive there. And then on the Chinese side, it's a drive to national greatness, right? You know, 1949, ending the period, as the Chinese see it, of the century of humiliation, which really in the grand sweep of history of several thousand years, the period from, let's say, the Opium Wars in the middle of the 19th century through to 1949 of a weak China was a bit of an anomaly, right? I mean, in most of your Asian history, there's been a strong central nation in the form of the, you know, the Middle Kingdom. That's not, wasn't the case for 100 years or so. China wants to regain what it regards, you know, with some justification, as its natural position as one of the leading global powers. I don't think it necessarily wants to replace the US as the dominant superpower across the whole globe. I don't think it would say no, right? But it's not a primary objective. The primary objective is to recover all it's the lost territory. And Taiwan in itself isn't so important. It's the reunification of Taiwan with the mainland would mean an end to the Chinese Civil War, which started in the 1920s, would finally reconcile all Chinese under a Han ethnic, you know, communist overlordship. And I think that's the ultimate goal. But the Chinese have gone from having a very long-term, patient, strategic approach to being much more aggressive and assertive now, and much more short-term in their thinking. And I think that has to do with, A, Xi Jinping being a much more autocratic leader who's much more of a single man ruling the country than any of his predecessors since really Mao. And the other issue is that he's a guy who's about to be 70 and he doesn't have a lot of time. So we're starting to get this kind of rush to war on both sides.
That's scary. I mean, those dynamics are scary. Firstly, on the US side, beautifully summarized. I mean, I think that really tells a story. The one thing I want to pick up on is on this idea that the narrative that US hegemony, US supremacy was good for everybody. At least that's what's in many ways believed on the Western side, and the West, us included, have really benefited and have enjoyed economic prosperity like the world hasn't seen before. Life expectancy has shot through the roof, et cetera, et cetera. But there will be many, certainly many nations around the world who would argue that they did not benefit. They were exploited for the benefits of the, let's so call it, the West, or, you know, US-led global world order. And that they are now seeing this as their opportunity, I guess, either for payback or to regain their own status, their own lost status. And here I'm talking about India, of course, China anyway, you know, Russia, the BRICS more broadly. There are many grievances towards the US that have accumulated over the last century that are perhaps now coming home to roost. What do you make of that view and us as the West understanding perhaps that view and empathizing with that view sufficiently?
Yeah, so this may come off as politically incorrect, but I think that we need to get out of our historical crouch about colonialism, which is not to defend colonialism. I think it was bad for lots of people, including the colonizers. Mm-hmm. But I think it's sort of like kryptonite to Western self-confidence and Western self-belief now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's gets weaponized by adversaries to try to minimize and distract from some of the things that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So an American nationalist would say that actually the rise of America to the position of global dominance coincided with the end of colonialism, right? It was actually the period of decolonization. And yes, you might criticize the US for having an informal empire, but after the Second World War, all the European empires basically went away within about 30 years. Probably the last to survive was the Portuguese until the middle of the 1970s. But basically, you know, all of that exploitative colonialism went away. And part of the reason for that was the US being in that dominant position. I think I have a lot of sympathy for, say, Indian or some African leaders saying, we want our fair share. We want to have our place in the sun. We want to be treated as equals and not treated as second-class citizens. And particularly in the case of India, right, which is undeniably a global power and needs to be given the, you know, the respect and credibility, for example, like in the form of a seat on the UN Security Council, right, to recognize that. When it shades over into a revenge narrative of, you know, we need to now punish all the people that, you know, share a skin color with those that colonized our countries, I think it becomes very destructive. And I think it becomes something that we just shouldn't be willing to tolerate, right? You've got people that were never colonial subjects attacking people that never were colonizers, right, over something that happened 100 years ago. And I'm not denying people's right to be upset about that, but I don't think it's a recipe for stability and prosperity going forward, right? I think it's a recipe actually for pretty serious internal and international conflict. So, you know, I think what we're seeing is a move from a unipolar system of US dominance after the end of the Cold War to more of a multipolar system. And if you listen to what the Chinese and the Russians and others say, they're not seeking to replace the US as the unipolar dominant power. They're seeking to just carve out spheres of influence that are outside of the sort of Western cultural and economic hegemony, which they find offensive. And again, like, I've got no beef with that. I think that's quite a legitimate national goal to pursue. In my book, The Dragons and the Snakes, I say, look, you know, Russia has a legitimate right, for example, to pursue what it regards as its own security interests in its near abroad, right? It has that right, but we have rights too. And when Russian objectives clash with ours, there's going to be conflict. And sometimes that conflict's going to rise to the level of war or proxy war, as we find now in Ukraine. That doesn't mean that it's illegitimate of the Russians to want to have a secure border, right? Everyone has their own legitimate security goals. It's sort of how you pursue those and whether you seek to enforce your own point of view on others without due consideration. And I'm very conscious in saying that the US and Western countries that fought in Iraq and Afghanistan really don't have much credibility now to be saying, you know, hey, you shouldn't be invading other people's countries and overthrowing regimes, right? So noted, but, you know, that doesn't make it untrue.
Yeah, but I guess, but that also is part of the issue, I guess, in the way the world views the West, you know, and I certainly didn't mean to go down colonialism per se or the guilt of the white man or anything like that or culture wars as we are now experiencing, certainly in the US, but even more broadly, that are really dividing kind of domestic cohesion in certainly in the US, but more from the perspective that if we are incapable of seeing the other perspective, the other view, and we're just strengthening our own, and we kind of galvanize around what we might call Western values, which, as you just pointed out, we've trampled on those values. So the values that we so hold dear, we have, or our elites that have led us to certain wars and conflicts have trampled on those values. And, you know, this is maybe a good time to talk about Iraq 2003.
Uh-huh.
It's come up so often in the podcast as the pivotal moment for where the demise of the West might have started, or the true kind of demise of the US has started, because it had gone into a war that has since been described as an illegal war. You know, whether it's the Chilcot inquiry, that's really found that, I think even in the US, the discussion is public, that it's been an illegal war fought on false premises, on dubious intelligence at best. Even our own intelligence agencies in Australia were casting shadows of doubts on that intelligence. But we as Australia went to that war, even though it didn't really meet the the conditions of our much-loved just war tradition, you know, and just some of those things would be being a last resort. Certainly wasn't. Right intention, questionable. Likelihood of success is a difficult one because everybody thinks they're going to win. But the most important one, perhaps, a just cause to go to war. So what do you think of that?
Yeah.
I mean, how does that land with you about Iraq being that kind of pivotal moment of West's demise, but also how much it's contributed to the loss of Western status, respect, credibility, influence in the world?
Yeah, so I'm not a just war theory expert, but I would say if we break it into sort of jus ad bellum and jus in bello, right, so the justice of going to war in the first place versus the justice with which the war was conducted, there's clearly issues on both counts with Iraq. I think Afghanistan was much more justifiable, right, as a just cause.
Yeah.
There were some problems with the execution of the war, but to say the least, right? But going to war in the first place was legitimate. It was a just cause. It was internationally approved, and so on. As a technical matter, I think you could probably make a case that the war in Iraq was not illegal. I mean, it was legal under U.S. law. It followed a UN Security Council resolution. You know, there are a bunch of other sort of formalistic things, right, that went through. But I do think it's true as a practical matter that the high watermark of US credibility, both politically and militarily, was, let's say, the 1 minute before that war began, right? And if you remember, the very first, and I wrote about this in my recent book, The Dragons and the Snakes, the very first move of the war was an attempt to assassinate Saddam and his sons at a place called Dora Farms outside of Baghdad at 5 a.m. on the first morning of the war, 19th of March, 2003. It was a classic example of what's wrong with how we do precision combat, right? So the strike was a technical masterpiece, right? It was carried out on only 8 hours' notice. It coordinated assets across multiple services across a very wide area. Precision strike hit exactly the house that it was aimed to hit. A few bombs went over the walls and killed about 20 civilians, but arguably the location where Saddam and his sons were believed to be was, you know, precisely targeted with a relatively minimal amount of collateral damage. But the intelligence turned out to be completely wrong. Saddam wasn't anywhere near there. He hadn't been there since the 1990s. His sons were in a completely different place. It wasn't until weeks later, when US troops finally got to that location, that they realized that actually about 20 civilians were killed in that strike. And I think it's been downhill from there, right? So I think downhill in a military sense, in that if the 1991 Gulf War showed everybody how not to fight us, you know, we'll kick your ass if you try to fight us like Saddam did. 2003 showed how to fight us, right? Blend in with the population, adopt a guerrilla strategy, low profile, hide in the cities, you know, all those sorts of things that now have become pretty standard in modern warfare are all adaptive responses to the way the US does high-tech precision engagement. And the fact that we struggled so badly in Iraq showed everybody that actually we're not invincible. And there's many ways to fight the US and win if you just can hang on. But I think the other really critical thing was the loss of moral legitimacy, right? So, you know, when the Russians first moved into Crimea in 2014, John Kerry, who was the Secretary of State, gave a speech where he said, look, it's completely unacceptable in the modern world for one country to just invade another country and try to overthrow its government and take chunks of territory. And, I mean, people just openly laughed at him for saying that, right? It's like, have you not been paying attention to what your own country's done in, like, Libya, Syria, you know? I mean, so I think we just don't have any credibility on moral grounds anymore. And for Australia, the situation was a little bit different. I was peripherally involved in the planning for Iraq. I was in Army headquarters. I wasn't on the the planning group, but I was involved in some of the irregular warfare piece that we thought was going to happen. At the end of the planning process, a very, very senior elected official came down to meet with the planners. And one of the questions that came up was, why are we doing this? And this elected leader said, look, you're asking the wrong question, right? The question is not, should Australia invade Iraq? The question is, the Americans are invading Iraq. Should we support them or not?
Mm.
And that was very much the Australian framing, right? It was framed as an alliance support effort, much as Afghanistan had been, and a desire to be alongside our ally and to demonstrate that we were credible and reliable in Australia's own interest, right? The idea of demonstrating a tight relationship with a global superpower as a way of achieving sort of extended deterrence, right? So that no one's gonna mess with Australia because they know. Mate. And look, that's you know, there's nothing wrong with that as a grand strategic framing. The problem with it is the operational, so campaign level. If your war aim is to.
If you'd like to hear the rest of this episode and gain access to all of the episodes of The Voices of War, simply become a subscriber using the link in the show notes. As you know, I will not feature any ads on the show, which is made possible solely through the support of our subscribers. If you find value in the content, you can become one now.